Hi there. We've got a lot we're really excited to tell you about, but I'm going to make this real quick so you can get to the episode. The deep dive is coming up at the end of January. The lineup of speakers is incredible and the range of topics is mind-blowing. You do not want to miss out on the last deep dive ever. Then the beta reader matchup is open once again with the matchups going out early in February. Sign up to kick your creative year off with a bang. Lastly, there's an amazing writer's workbook available, which will make the perfect gift for you or the writer in your life. Head to our website, The Shit About Writing, to find out more. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another Books with Hooks segment. As per usual, we are going to dive straight in. Cece, will you please kick us off with the first query?
Let's do this. Dear Cece, I'm seeking representation for my debut novel, All These Things That I Have Done, Contemporary Literary Fiction, 93,000 Words, a darkly comic, character-driven exploration of addiction, regret, and reluctant redemption. Told in a raw, witty, first-person voice interwoven with screenplay entries that blur memory, dream, and reality. Fans of Chuck Palahniuk's Choke and Matthew Quick's The Silver Linings Playbook will recognize the razor's edge balance of humor and heartbreak, while readers of memoirs like Nick Sheff's Tweak and David Sheff's Beautiful Boy will connect with its unflinching confrontation of trauma, family, and forgiveness. When news of his father's death forces Sal de Lucia, a once best-selling author turned disgraced screenwriter, onto a red eye from Los Angeles to Connecticut, he has no choice but to return to the hometown he's avoided for over a decade. Broke, off the wagon, and on the verge of breaching his contract, Sal finds himself back in his childhood bedroom, face to face with the family he abandoned. There, he collides with his estranged 17-year-old daughter, Stella, a sharp, wounded rebel whose struggles echo his own. Their uneasy connection becomes both muse and mirror as Saul enlists her help to finish a long-abandoned manuscript, hoping to salvage not only his career, but his fractured sense of fatherhood. But haunted by guilt over his unborn son's death, tethered to an addiction that refuses to loosen its grip, and afraid Stella is following his path, Saul must decide whether the second chance will be another spectacular failure or the first step towards redemption. I hold a master's degree in English and teach inner city high school theater in New Haven, Connecticut. My short fiction has received awards, and I wrote, produced, and acted in the independent feature film This Wretched Life, 2010. As a recovering addict of more than a decade, I feel a responsibility to tell stories that confront stigma while offering hope. Thank you very much for your consideration, Salvatore De Lucia.
Awesome, Cece. Thank you so much. So can you please first give us the word count on that and then your take on it?
The word count is 322 words. Okay, my take. So first paragraph, quite a bit to discuss in the first paragraph. One, you're leading with themes. You know, the first thing that you tell me about your story, in addition to the title and the genre and the word count, is exploration of addiction, regret, and redemption. These are themes, and these are really awesome themes, things that are really interesting and can make for awesome stories. But, you know, we always say on the show, lead with your hook. Don't lead with your themes. It's really important to know your themes, but don't start with that. Further, and still on the subject of themes, when you share your comps, you are also sharing more themes that these comps are bringing to the table. Confrontation of trauma, family, forgiveness. And so, again, it's just a lot of theme overload for my taste specifically. So I don't think that that's the best way to start your query letter. I also think that four comps is too much. Like, again, you're using four, and I just don't think that four are needed. I would choose the two that you feel best portray your story. And this is something that I always tell authors. And it's a small thing, but that can make a big difference. You don't have to tell us whether the story is in first person, third person, whatever person it is. It's awesome that you know that, and we'll find out when we read the pages, but it's just extra words in your query letter. And again, the query letter is really precious real estate. We want to make sure that every single word there needs to be there and is in the right place. So those are my thoughts on the first paragraph. The first paragraph that tells me about the plot does an excellent job of telling me the protagonist's place in the world. You know, he was once a best-selling novelist turned disgraced screenwriter, and it does a great job of telling me the inciting incident. His father died, he needs to return home. So it started off really strong. After that, there are challenges to this query letter, but I don't necessarily think they're mistakes. There is a difference between a challenge and a mistake. What are the challenges? Everything here after the inciting incident is quite internal. Him and his daughter, they have to find their way back to each other. You know, he's haunted by guilt, tethered to addiction. All of this is promising a very internal plot, which is fine. Literary fiction can have an interiority-driven plot. There are beautiful literary fiction novels out there that are exactly like this, and they work really, really well. It all comes down to the execution, right? It'll depend on whether the author has really strong writing on a line level, really strong storytelling skills. So it's not necessarily a mistake as long as the author's vision is to have a quiet story. But I am pointing this out so that the author is aware. Your query letter is coming off as, I'm going to give you, dear agent, a quiet story. If that is your vision, if that matches what you're delivering, great. If it doesn't, then you have to rethink it. And to every listener out there who is writing a quiet story, this is a good example of how to frame it. And if you're thinking to yourself, oh, I'm worried that my story is coming across quiet, and I don't want that, this is an example, again, of how one does think a story is quiet. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, handing it across to you.
I agree with everything Cece said, so I won't rehash that. But one of the things that I think is crucial here is focusing on more of the why he's going home. Because it says news of his father's death, no choice but to return home. He ends up face to face with the family, you know, collides with the daughter, has to finish the manuscript. But you don't really get at the like why he has to go home per se. Like, is it because the father was taking care of the estranged daughter? Where's this estranged wife? I guess I want a bit of a framing of he has to go home to close up the father's estate. You don't spell it out exactly why he has to go home so that we have like a bookend on the home part. I think that to me would help frame this a little bit more clearly about why he's going home. Because somebody's father can pass away and then, you know, you don't go home, right? There has to be a reason here to go home. Obviously, you know, he's broke. Maybe he has nowhere to live. He has to live in the father's house. What if he has to clean up the father's house and flip it so that he can sell it so that now he now has money to fund the rest of his writing career? Like, I just want a reason for the going home, to be clear. I have a feeling it's in the manuscript. It's just not in the query. So that's my main note.
Awesome, Carly. Thank you. Okay, Cece, we're going to go to the pages now. Can you please let us know what's in them and then we'll hear your take on them?
Sure. So we begin with our protagonist in a shuttle. His agent calls, it's his literary agent, and his literary agent is basically telling him, you have to go home to your father's funeral, the ticket's waiting at the airport. The agent isn't telling him that his father died, and he's saying, no, let's talk about this. And he's like, well, you were in rehab before, and the only reason why you're not in rehab now is because you're going to the funeral. Let me make this clear. The scene is interrupted. The screenplay begins, promised in the query letter. The screenplay is essentially a Sal, the protagonist, in rehab, and there are people who are concerned that he tried to hurt himself, but really it was autoerotic asphyxiation. And essentially that is what happens. And then we're back to the car, and his agent says, listen, sober or not, you confess to a room full of mental health professionals that, you know, you just tried autoerotic asphyxiation. You work in this town. I work in this town. You know, you have to go home. You have to go to the funeral. And the studio is expecting a full draft by the end of next month. So that's the interaction.
Okay, so let's hear your take on that.
So I have a few notes. The first is that I don't think that the format of pausing the narrative to go into the screenplay is working. Obviously, all of storytelling is a matter of taste, but for my taste, it felt really jarring. And especially because like it was still him, you know, it was still him in the screenplay. I was like, wait, what? And to be fair, the author was very honest with us about this. You know, his query letter says that the screenplay entries are there and they blur memory, dream, and reality. So for me, for my taste, that is really hard to pull off and still feel cohesive and still feel like it's an organic part of the story. And it didn't work for me. Like, the execution didn't work for me. It took me out of the scene. It didn't do the job of keeping me invested. And then my second note is, I'm just confused about him and this agent. Like, it doesn't seem plausible to me. Reading their interaction made me feel confused, not curious. Like, I don't understand why his agent is forcing him to go to the funeral. Their whole dynamics didn't feel believable. Why does the studio need him to write the script so badly? Like, writers are replaced like that in Hollywood. Maybe if he owns the rights to something, he wouldn't be. And if he's like super duper famous, but he's not, clearly. So, also, was he writing from rehab? I don't know. To me, I don't think you're starting in the right place, because whenever a story starts with the conversation between two characters who are essentially talking about what happened right before, that alone is a challenge. That's like catching us up. Plus, the fact that I know I'm not a literary agent in the script sense, Hollywood sense, but I don't think that this is how agents and their clients would be interacting. Like, the whole forcing him to go to the funeral, shaming him about his autoerotic asphyxiation. It's LA. People have kinks. I don't think it's that big of a deal. Maybe it is. I don't know. Maybe people are prudish there. I doubt it. Like, I sincerely doubt it. Yeah, I guess everyone goes to rehab. Everyone has their kinks, right? I just don't think it's that big of a deal. So to me, I felt like I didn't believe what was happening here, you know? And this is something that's actually really common when writers write from a place that they might want to be in, but they're not in. Like, if someone really wants to have an agent and they really want to have a rapport with their agent, they might write a scene where the agent is acting in a certain way. But if that's not believable to someone who's reading it, someone who is an agent, then that might actually be shooting yourself in the foot, you know? And I know different agents act in different ways, for sure. Like, I get all that. It just, again, didn't feel believable to me.
Thank you, Cece. I mean, in this kind of instance, you know, that I don't think is a difficult fix, because you can always just have that they are like, perhaps best friends that have gone back for years, and his best friend also happens to be his agent. And so he's speaking from a place of being his best friend who has his best interests at heart and also being an agent. But like you say, it has to be plausible. Yes, Cece?
And the author did establish that. They are friends as well. I do want to make that clear. It still doesn't explain the studio thing. Still doesn't explain the kink shaming thing. You know, like, the fact that someone would perhaps be more friendly and be more invasive because you're a friend, sure. But it doesn't, the rest doesn't add up for me, but it's me, you know?
Right. Perfect. Okay, Carly, let's hear your thoughts.
One thing that we didn't talk about in the query letter, which I want to bring up because it's now relevant, is this character's name is Sal and our author's name is Sal. And so we didn't really talk about this in the query letter, but obviously it's bringing it around to me now, because are we supposed to assume that these two people are the same people? Is this some sort of autofiction, or is the idea that we are supposed to wonder if it's autofiction? Like, I'm just trying to figure out what the layers are there, because you wouldn't name your character after yourself unless there was some intentionality about what you're trying to do there. Overall, I agree with Cece, of course. I don't think that this screenplay interstitial is working at all. It definitely comes off as experimental and repeating itself. And I just think there's other ways to play with memory than really changing format, because that's incredibly jarring to the reader's experience of the book. This really reminded me of, and I don't know if you guys watched this at all, Californication, which was a show in like the 2000s, 2010s. I can't remember how old it was. This was giving me Californication vibes for sure. And it was a great show. It was also like pretty raunchy, you know, had its moments of ups and downs, not very feminist at all. So again, I'm probably not the target audience for maybe this book, which is potentially why it's not connecting with me. But I definitely wonder about, yeah, who the audience for this book is. If it's that Californication type of viewer/reader, then that show did really well. That show was also like almost 20 years old, I think, at this point, or 15 years old at this point, right? So we also have to, like, we are trying to approach that lens, what are we doing in the year 2025, I guess is what I'm getting at with this. I also had the notes about him and the agent relationship. You know, there's all of these examples in Hollywood, though, with like hacks, you know, when it's like the agent-client relationship is blurred. And it's for the sake of the story, of course, which we know, but we can't have it bring the reader out of the reading experience, right? It has to be seamless, and there has to be a reason for why the agent client relationship is so personal. But you know, it's not impossible, that's for sure.
All right. Thank you both. Right. Before we move on to our next query, let's hear from our sponsors.
Hey, everybody. Guess who's back from France? I was thinking of you guys listening to me talk about getting ready for the trip and practicing my French while I was doing my best to order en français at the cafes. It went well. I was a bit nervous, but when we were in the countryside and I could take my time thinking about what I wanted to say, I was able to say it. Being a bilingual family is high on my list of things that are super important to me as a parent and a mom. If we're going to show them the world, we also need to appreciate and respect the language and culture by learning it. Imagine how much richer your travel experience could be if you could speak the local languages when you travel. With Rosetta Stone, you'll gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you go. Rosetta Stone is the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. You can learn faster and retain longer. There's no English translations. You truly learn to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. There's an intuitive learning process. You start with words, build to phrases, and progress to full sentences. It's designed for long-term retention, so it sticks with you. You can work on your accent with the built-in True Accent speech recognition technology, so it'll help you sound more natural. You can learn anytime, anywhere. It fits with your lifestyle with a flexible on-the-go learning style, desktop or mobile app. And there's incredible value. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. The Shit About Writing listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/ today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/ today and start learning today. The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. I know our crowd would love the Book Nook Reading Valet. It's a wood holder for your book, your mug, your reading glasses, e-reader, and or a phone, so you can carry it from your room to your bedside to the bathtub. It has a 4.9 out of 5 rating on over 178 reviews. I also thought you guys would like, all of you pet lovers out there, would like the custom pet embroidered sweatshirt, so you can have a custom portrait of your animal on your sweater and have them with you all day. Uncommon Goods has something for everybody, from moms and dads to kids and teens, book lovers, sports fans and foodies, gardeners, crafters, readers and writers. You will find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes, because you can make your money go farther this holiday season, because with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. That is incredible stuff. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/tsnotyaw. That's uncommongoods.com/TSNOTYAW for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer, Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Okay, great. Carly, will you please read us your query letter?
Dear Carly, Cece, and Bianca, I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed and learned from your podcast without blowing up the word count for this letter. Thank you for this gift. 30-something attorney Stella Day is used to settling for less in relationships until she meets a younger man who wants to give her everything. But when she discovers his unwitting ties to a colleague who harmed her, she is torn between justice and the kind of love she was sure she'd never find. 3-Date Minimum is a contemporary romance complete at 80,000 words. It combines the clever banter and emotional depth of Julia Whelan's Thank You for Listening with the female empowerment of Moxie by Jennifer Metu. Blue-eyed Stella is barreling through the dating apps. Her strategy? 1. only date men of the settling down age. 2, avoid pesky topics like marriage and kids. 3, hold back the ultimate man repellent, a woman's tears. Stella is regrouping after another breakup when she encounters Simon at a Chicago bar. At 26, Simon is an old soul yearning for the lifelong love his Peruvian grandparents modeled, but Stella doesn't think he checks her boxes and she's hesitant to waste time. Mixed signals between Stella and Simon lead to a disastrous start until he earnestly asks for 3 dates. Stella's chemistry with Simon and her pushy best friend nudge her to agree. As the dates unfold, Simon continually shows up for Stella. She begins to feel secure enough to ask for what she wants in a relationship, and she gets it. Then Stella learns the man who sexually assaulted her is connected to Simon. Blinded by unresolved pain and afraid Simon won't believe her, she determines breaking up is the only way forward. With her predator targeting more women and her job on the line, Stella will have to choose whether to speak out or continue to let fear control her. She will also have to decide if she's worthy of the deep, satisfying love she found with Simon or risk never finding it again. I'm a former elected official who turned to romance for the happy endings that were scarce in my political career. I publish a newspaper column and manage various social media channels. This is my debut novel. Thank you for your consideration. Sincerely, Redacted.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, word count there and then your take on that.
It came in at 355 words minus the pleasantries, which the author subtracted for us, which was great. Okay, so all of my thoughts here. I have a lot of thoughts about this. I think I've told you guys before, I usually read everything right before we record. I actually started reading this last night because I had a busy morning and I was trying to sit with it a little bit and kind of like figure out what my thoughts were on it. Because it took, sometimes as an agent, I do this thing where I've talked about this before on the show, where I'm very lucky. I just get to scroll through query letters and, you know, this is for me, this isn't for me. And on the show, it forces me to think about why this isn't for me and maybe what's not working. I think what I was stumbling with, and it kind of came to me before we started recording, is when romance novel pitches focus solely on the element of romance alone and only focus on the A plot, I struggle with the pitch because I don't actually know what's happening with this character. And if I don't know who this character is, then how can I frame the romance around the contextuality of her life? And so really the only contextual information we get is that this character was sexually harassed, I think is the word. The man who sexually harassed her. That's kind of the only framing information we have about this character. We learn that, you know, she might lose her job. Like, I don't know. I just want to know, like, what is the job? Like, what is her passion? Because it comes off in this pitch, and this happens in a lot of romance pitches, that this character's only goal is to find a mate. And this character's only goal is to find a partner. And for me, I really like when the query letter can focus a little bit more on what this character has going on in their life so that we can understand how the romance fits within the larger structure of what they want. I really like in this query letter that there's like potentially like a May-December thing going on in terms of like a younger man. I love that. I think that's super interesting. I just want to know a bit more what is happening in her life. Like, what is her job? Because we get to the point here in the query letter, which I was like, whoa, with her predator targeting more women and her job on the line. I was like, whoa, like, is this a thriller? What do we mean by targeting? And her job is on the line. What is her job? I'm scrolling around as I'm reading here, trying to figure out if we ever hear what her job is. But I don't really think that it's spelled out what her job is, right? So if her predator is targeting more women, is this a thriller? What kind of targeting are we talking about? Because I actually feel like if I saw this query and it didn't say contemporary romance, I actually wouldn't think this would be a romance novel. I would actually think this is a book club novel or something that's like trying to create a conversation around something larger. And it happens to use romance as the vehicle of the A plot of like what we're trying to do here. So I think this book is a little confused or this query letter is a little confused. I haven't been able to deduct which one because I need to, you know, think on it a little bit more. But unfortunately, when we're reading query letters as agents, we don't noodle as much as I've been noodling on this query letter. So if this was pitched to me, I actually wouldn't call this a romance. But again, it's hard for me to say. So I feel like this is a teensy bit confused. The other thing that's confusing here is the comps. Moxie by Jennifer Mathieu is a YA novel. That isn't an adult novel. So that's why I'm like, this book feels very confused to me. Very interesting. As I said, I love a May-December story with an older woman, younger man. Sign me up for that. But other than that, I'm like, I'm really trying to figure out what this book is. And it's not that it's not interesting, but my job is I do have to kind of put this in a box and I haven't really been able to figure out what it is, unfortunately. So that is my take, and I'll turn it back over to you ladies.
Awesome. Thanks, Carly. Okay, Cece, over to you.
I love how there are listeners who are probably keeping a list of the things we are most into. And with Carly's list, they just added older woman, younger man, check.
My husband is two weeks younger than me, okay? My husband is 2 weeks younger than me.
2 weeks counts. That counts.
And earlier they were getting CC kinks and rehab that we all have and we've all been to. Check.
Yeah. No kink shaming. No kink shaming. I'm saying no to kink shaming. Let people be happy. Consenting people be happy. Okay. I agree with everything Carly said. I thought that was actually so brilliant about the A plot and the B plot. And it is exactly what is missing here. I hadn't put my finger on it. So right. I understood what was missing for me as I was hearing you speak, Carly. So 1,000% agree. I also think I kind of wanted to know, how is he connected to Simon? Like, that to me was vague. Connected to Simon how? Something I really loved about this query letter, which I'd like to highlight, is the first line of the author paragraph, which reads, "I am a former elected official who turned to romance for the happy endings that were scarce in my political career." Not only is that an adorable line, love it, but also, what if the author is channeling that, right? Is tapping into that experience. And this person's job is the same or similar, you know? What if we're talking about a romance that's kind of like West Wingy, walk and talk fast, you know, filled with political intrigue and that really strong B plot? If that is you, then I think that you're doing yourself a disservice by not highlighting that in your query letter, because it could be so much more exciting. And I know, word count. Someone's probably going, well, you're saying it has to be under 300 words, and how are we supposed to do that? I don't know. I don't know. That is not my job to tell you. But I do think that we need to know more about her profession, especially if it's going to be a really cool profession that's going to make me see these two sides of her, you know, her cynical political side, but then also her romantic, you know, believing in love side. Like, that's really interesting. Contradictions are really interesting. So that's very exciting to me. Something else that I will say as a very minor thing that could actually be major. Don't like what this says about people in my profession, mine and Carly's profession, but agents sometimes will kind of gloss their eyes over a query letter. And if something isn't looking right, they might not even read it. Sorry, it's just the reality of life. And one of the things that agents are kind of on the lookout for, Carly and I don't do this, by the way, guys, okay? But like, you're going to query this widely, right? This whole list thing, this is a bad idea. Don't put lists in a query letter. 1, 2, 3. Like, we get a lot of query letters that go, this is why you should buy this book. 1, and then there's delusional reason number 1. 2, delusional reason number 2. 3, delusional reason number 3. It's going to be bigger than Jurassic Park. I know that's not what you're doing. I know that's not what this list is doing, but our eyes reading queries in batches could very easily go, delusional format, listicle thing. Don't do it. You can keep the listicle format, but make it in paragraphs. You know, her strategy is to only date men of the settling down age, avoid pesky topics and hold back on blah, blah, blah. Great. Format your query letter in a way that reads like pitch copy in the back of a book. Very important. It's unfair. It's unjust. It is also reality. We like living in reality on this show. So there you go.
Thank you, Cece. Yeah, for those of you who subscribe to our Substack, you will be able to see the actual query letter and how the list is in there so that you can see what Cece is referring to. And something else I just want to add here is that we've actually had quite a few conversations recently on the podcast in our author interviews about choosing occupations for your characters that are not just some background thing, just something for them to do, because an occupation says so much about who a character is. It should create plot point elements. I was chatting with Hannah Mary McKinnon, and we were talking about how she gave her character a completely different occupation, and then her agent was like, no, you've made this way too complicated. You've created that this person makes mystery boxes that they send to people and people need to try and figure them out. And the agent was like, just make her a podcaster. And Hannah was like, oh my God, yes, a podcaster. And it made so much sense in the context of the story that I couldn't believe that she hadn't just started with the podcaster. So important. Don't just go, okay, occupation, it's so-and-so. It really needs to create opportunities for plot, reveal stuff about character, move the momentum of the story forward, and create tension and intrigue, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, Carly, we're handing across to you now. Will you tell us what was in the opening pages?
Absolutely. Those are great notes from Bianca, and I'm going to come back to that with my analysis. So we start with our main character sitting across from Grant. They are, it seemed like on some sort of date or just like outing as a couple. They are having a drink together. We know that they're in Chicago. She talks about kind of like her dating app experience and then obviously being with Grant. We learn that they are moving in together, and then she's surprised that he hasn't started packing yet. And then he says, oh, okay, made me realize maybe I'm not sure we're ready to take this step. And so she's like, whoa, this is a huge piece of information. And so they kind of feel like they're maybe not ready. It's one of those things where it's like, who breaks up with who? I don't know. But they break up. She's very caught off guard. They part ways. She says goodbye, throws some money on the table, texts a friend being like, we just broke up. She goes from sitting at the table to sitting at the bar, and then kind of waits for a bartender to serve her. And apparently as she's like sitting there waiting for her next drink, somebody is, you know, coming to flirt with her, and the bartender just kind of warns her, and that is where it ends.
Thank you, Carly. That brought to mind immediately the song Austin by Dasha. There's the lyrics that goes, got a hunch down in my guts and snuck around the back, empty cans and I'll be damned, your shit was never packed. It gave me strong Dasha vibes, which I really like.
Okay, well, I expect the TikTok dance now. There's a TikTok dance with that song, isn't there? Where they hit the boot. That's the, if you, I mean, I'm not huge on TikTok, but if you've seen the video where people are like slapping their boots, doing a little bit of line dancing, that they do that to that song. So get your boots.
Bianca, you have to dance now. You have to dance.
Nobody wants to see you dance, I can promise.
Line dance.
Everybody wants to see you dance.
No one wants to see me sing or dance. Okay, so let's change the subject. Carly, what was your take?
Well, unfortunately, they don't line dance. But okay, so coming back to what Bianca was saying about the career, like, to me, that was just so important. And it really just shines through in this, because it seems to me, again, this book seems so focused on finding a man, finding a partner on the dating apps. Is this my person? You know, I'm 34. I'm swiping, a very like dating culture entry point. I was actually shocked when I got to the end of the first page to realize that these two were actually in a relationship. I thought they were just on like a random date, the way that they're interacting with each other actually. And then it was like, we're moving in together? What? I don't know. I just didn't really feel like the entry point of talking about the swiping and the dating framed it that I understood that these two are actually in a long-term committed relationship. It doesn't really say, I don't think, how long that they've been together before, unless I missed it. But they go from like talking about dating to, you know, all of a sudden they're not moving in together. He's 45. She is 34. We understand that. Anyway, basically, I just feel like I don't know anything about her, because she talks about Grant and then she talks about Ryan, trust fund baby, passionate about weaving and drum circles, Travis, uptight logistics coordinator, you know, runs through her dating history, gets to Grant, and I still don't know anything about her. She throws the money down on the table, talks about how they're going to, you know, split up their belongings. And then she's like off to the bar to sit down and have a drink. All of this is very normal. I'm not saying none of this is like out of the ordinary, but I definitely feel like in this day and age, especially when a woman thinks about, and especially a character, a female character, right? Like thinks about their identity isn't just as like a dating person. It feels very much like I'm just seeking somebody to complete me. Whereas, again, I know some people definitely feel this way, but maybe I just feel so strongly about my career and my passion that I know so many women feel like their identity is so tied up in who they are, that no mention, like there's a mention of a friend, which is great, but there's no mention of career or like goals. And it's not, again, it could be, she doesn't, you know, not everybody has to have a goal and a career and a passion, but I'm like, everybody's passionate about something. And the fact that this is coming off as if this character is only passionate about finding their partner. And I think that's where I'm struggling. And I just want to know more about her. Because there's just so much about all the men. There's, you know, commentary on Grant, every man she's dated, what the bartender looks like. And I just don't understand her at all. And it just feels, it's just not sitting right with me just to not know her. Because my point of view as a female reader reading this romance novel, I'm going to want to associate my experience with the female character. And I just can't place myself or contextualize her at all. Yeah. So anyway, that's where I'm struggling. I just want to know what her deal is. why does she want a man so bad? You know, why can't we just figure out maybe this isn't the right time for her? Or yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just struggling. And maybe this is just a sign that this isn't starting in the right place, because it just comes off a little bit rom-com-y to me, or just, again, so focused on this is the only way out, or this is the only version of my self-expression. And as a female reader, that's just, I don't know, not the right book for me, maybe. But anyway, I'll end there because I don't think I'm adding anything else to the conversation. So Cece, what did you think?
Just before we go across to Cece, what I'm thinking as an author is that this person might be focusing on the aspect of this character's life that they are dissatisfied with. So it may be that they have a very satisfying career and therefore that's not on their mind. And so what they're really focusing on is the part of their life that they're dissatisfied with. But that might be a mistake. So in case that is something that the author is doing, you know, we still want to show that there is a part of their life that does greatly fulfill them and satisfy them, but this is the one aspect that they're not satisfied with.
I agree with that. And I was just going to say, like, to chime in on that, like what I was looking for, I agree with you, that would have been fine. What I was looking for was something even like, for example, like I'm just looking at the first page, right? It says, Grant stares at his drained glass where a curl of orange peel sits atop sad melting ice cubes. Maybe she's a furniture designer and she's like, I can't believe Grant is letting that, you know, that condensating glass, condensating is a word, the glass with condensation on this walnut table. He knows that you use a coaster when you, you know what I'm trying to say? Like, yeah. There just has to be something that relates what is happening in this scene to a passion of hers. And yeah, I agree with everything Bianca said.
Yeah. Okay, Cece?
Definitely won't echo that so that we talk about new things. I agree though. I agree with everything that's been said. So my big note is this. I am sure that this writer wants these pages to have a lot of tension. I know this because every writer wants their pages to have a lot of tension, as they should. Tension's very important. And right now, you have framed this breakup in a way where tension is leaking. I want you to picture a bowl of water. That's your story. And I want you to picture a faucet that's open, right? That's the tension. So the water is going inside the bowl of water. The water is tension. The bowl of water is your story. Technically, a breakup scene, great opportunity for tension. But because of the way it's been framed, it's like there are little holes underneath the bowl where all the tension is leaking. It's not working. What are the holes where tension is leaking? It's the fact that she can anticipate what's coming. This starts with, I've been here before too many times to count. We get visuals on Grant, and then she thinks to herself, I sense what's coming. And then he breaks up with her. He says, I'm not sure we're ready to take the step, or, you know, he initiates the breakup. And when I read that, I was like, I'm not surprised. You know why I'm not surprised as a reader? Because she's not surprised as a protagonist. So you have essentially stripped this of the element of surprise by having her correctly anticipate what is about to happen. A lot of people think that if they have their protagonist anticipate what's about to happen, they are showing that their protagonist is savvy and intelligent. And yes, we all want savvy and intelligent protagonists. But actually, even savvy and intelligent people get things wrong. And showing blind sides is really important when showing intelligent and savvy people. She should be convinced that something is wrong and that he is about to say something because she is perceptive and observant. But she should not be guessing correctly. In her mind, his stuff is packed and he's about to say something else, something specific, something intelligent, something that hopefully zooms out and shares more about both of their lives, both of their jobs, everything else, right? And then when he says, I'm just not sure we're ready to take this step, maybe she even misunderstands. Maybe she thinks it's the step about, I don't know, XYZ, whatever it is. And she's like, wait, what are you talking about? You know, and he's like, no, I mean our relationship. And then it would be like, wow. She would be shocked. The reader would be shocked. And even if the reader was like, I could see it coming because of the jacket copy or the tone of the book, that's fine. When the reader and the protagonist aren't perfectly aligned, that's actually super interesting and could be a source of tension too. Because the reader is going, no, she doesn't see it. And so we're rooting for her. We have that emotional investment. It's actually really important. I will say this. I loved her external reaction to the breakup. When he gets up and he puts money on the table and, you know, she decides to be like super dignified about it. She's like, nope, I'm going to treat this in a very professional manner almost. Like, I liked the difference between what was going on in her interiority, where she was breaking, but she didn't show it. And that to me is a sign of an author who knows what they're doing, because it's really important for your interiority to show something that's different from what's happening on the outside, whether it's an extra layer or a contradiction or something else. But you did that, and that was awesome. And just as a woman, I was like, you go, girl. You know, like, I love this. I love this. Thank you so much. Thank you for, you know, being strong enough to do that. So yeah, I really, really liked that she was keeping her cool. I will say this, though, about her reaction, which, again, I liked. When she says, you know, I have a few of your things at my place, I'll ship them to you. If you could do the same, that would be appreciated. I'll go ahead and take my keys now. Again, she's being super strong. What we get after that, the line right after that, is him fishing the key out of his wallet. That, to me, is a mistake. The line right after that needs to be her tracking his face, her tracking his body expression, her tracking anything in him. Why? Because the reader wants that payoff. You've created a scene that's actually very satisfying. You've created a scene where it's like, yes, show him. Show him that you will not be broken in front of him. And so I'm like rooting for her, invested in her. And I want the payoff. I want his reaction. I want his surprise. And it's not that we don't get any hint of a surprise. We do, but it's in the wrong place and it's not enough. I want more. And I did highlight, our Substack subscribers will see it. I highlighted all the instances where I was like, this is where you write this. This is where you write that, to give us that payoff, to give us that payoff. And when you did, it was really good. There's a line that reads, this gives me a tiny measure of satisfaction, but then I feel ashamed. Again, layers of emotions. So excellent. Like, you clearly have the potential for a really awesome story here. I think what's missing is the tension calibration. And again, more layers to her, right? To your protagonist. But overall, great job.
Thank you, Cece. I loved what you said there about blindsides, because I don't watch a lot of reality television, but when I watch Survivor or something like Traitors, my favorite part is always the blindside. And there'll be some character who's telling, you know, the producers how they're in charge of everything and they've got everybody under their control and they know the vote's going to go their way. And then suddenly there's the blind side and you can see the shock on this person's face when they thought that they were running the show and they weren't. And that always is my favorite part of reality shows, is that kind of tension. So something for all of us to keep in mind. Okay, so next week we're back to our author interview, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another Books with Hooks. Thanks so much, Carly and Cece. See you again soon. Bye.
Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. Hi there. We've got a lot we're really excited to tell you about, but I'm going to make this real quick so you can get to the episode. The deep dive is coming up at the end of January. The lineup of speakers is incredible and the range of topics is mind-blowing. You do not want to miss out on the last deep dive ever. Then the beta reader matchup is open once again, with the matchups going out early in February. Sign up to kick your creative year off with a bang. Lastly, there's an amazing writer's workbook available, which will make the perfect gift for you or the writer in your life. Head to our website, The Shit About Writing, to find out more.